Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the FCC. Please continue to finish your lunch. But as we have such a distinguished speaker here today, I thought I'd kick off proceedings. And I'll start just with some housekeeping. Obviously, cell phones will all be off to silent so we can pay full attention. And we have actually a tremendous group of speakers this week. Starting with Professor Cohen today, we've got Mark O'Neill, who's actually here in the audience today, speaking tomorrow. A fantastic topic on the biggest NGO in the world, the Suu Kyi Foundation. And then we have Edward Stokes the day after, talking about Hong Kong nature landscapes. Then we'll have a little bit break till another group of speakers coming up later in the summer. Our speaker today, Professor Cohen, needs no introduction, obviously, and I think all of you here today are fully aware of his contributions to law, the rule of law, and to U.S.-China relations. He'll be talking to us today about how to improve China's soft power, and also raising the question about how America's soft power is doing. In terms of Professor Cohen's soft power, I think I'd just like to share with you that you may not know that he was in China before coming here, and I think it's no coincidence that on Sunday the top five judicial and legal authorities in China announced that they were scrapping the use of torture in court proceedings in China. So, without further ado, Professor Cohen.
Douglas knows my penchant for claiming credit for lots of things I've had nothing to do with. And apropos that announcement, however, it is part of our subject today. I was told it was coming out a couple of weeks ago when I was in Beijing. And it shows that under the surface, however discouraging many developments concerning law in China are, there's a lot going on, and I'll come back to that. I should say first, I'm very happy to be back here again. I always find this an important forum. I get good questions. I see old friends, meet some new ones. Now, soft power began to be overtly important to China several years ago. Soft power, as Joe Nye, my former Harvard colleague, told us, means a country's reputation for progress, prowess, in matters other than political or military. Soft power often reflects the quality of a country's civilization and its impact on the world. And China began to use the term soft power. And the Olympics, of course, were an arch example of very impressive display of soft power. I was just Thursday at Expo in Shanghai. Apart from the US pavilion, it's a very impressive display of China's ability to attract many countries' soft power. And don't miss the Italy pavilion above all. The French pavilion has wonderful food, but be sure to take your wallet and check it when you leave. But China began to decide it would do more with outreach to the world. And since they had resurrected Confucius, they began to use him as a symbol of rising Chinese nationalism, de-emphasizing communism, emphasizing Chinese culture, literature, language, wisdom, for which Confucius has always stood. I should tell you a quick story about Confucius. When I started studying Chinese in 1960, my highly literate tutor in Berkeley, California, gave me the name of Confucius, Kong, because it sounds like Cohen and Confucius gave a lot of good advice about law, dispute resolution, etc. And I kept that name very proudly until my first visit to China 12 years later. I was known by that name in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, and outside of China in the Chinese-speaking world. But when I got to China in May of 72, my host organization, the Chinese Academy of Sciences, they said, "Busheng, Jiga Mingzi Busheng, this name isn't good." And I said, "Why not?" And they said, "Womendo Pi Lin Pi Kong, we're all criticizing Lin Biao and Confucius." This was the famous nationwide 1972 mass movement. And they told me the name of Confucius was a feudalistic name, and they would give me a new name, a name of the Wuchan Jeji, the masses of China, the impoverished, etc. So I would have a good revolutionary background. So they gave me a simple name, Ka'en. Ka is Muzipan, the Ka, not Kushwe, science, but the ordinary Ka family name of the 100 names of China. And Un is Zhou Enlai. I like Zhou Enlai. I met him on that trip. It made me feel nice. Un has a nice meaning. So without much thought, I started using Ka'en in China. Well, later when I helped push the US and China toward normalization in the later 70s, took Ted Kennedy and family to China, 77. Taiwan newspapers criticized me, someone who abandoned the name of Confucius. How could you trust anybody like that? They continued, fortunately, to use the name of Kong. But now, as a result of soft power, China has mobilized Confucius. He's no longer verboten. He's their maximum weapon abroad in the soft power struggle. And now I notice in China, they're beginning to use my original name. So on my new card, I have to use both names. Otherwise, the confusion becomes intolerable. So you see, I have a personal interest in this whole soft power thing. Now, Chiang Kai-shek and Madame Zheng didn't know the term soft power. Zhou and I hadn't coined it until much later. But they were masters of soft power. They knew how to manipulate the US Congress, often the US government, and they really managed to do far more than their limited power and achievement might have justified. Knowing that Chiang Kai-shek always claimed to be the principal supporter of Chinese civilization, especially Confucianism, when I had a chance to meet him in 1968, I was told by his handlers before going in, "The president asks every guest, how can we improve ourselves?" And since I had a wonderful former student who had trained to become a terrific legal historian of China but couldn't find a job when he got back to Taiwan from Harvard, instead of shouting freedom when Chiang Kai-shek asked me what they should do in Taiwan, that would have been a one-way ticket to the airport, I said, "Mr. President, you're always emphasizing Chinese civilization, the Qing Dynasty contributions. Why don't you create a position in Chinese legal history at Academia Sinica?" And he did, and my protege has gone on to do great things. So soft power in practice is not something new to China. I think John Fairbank, about 1961, gave something called the Brian McMahon Lecture at University of Connecticut, where he analyzed carefully the Kuomintang's sophisticated manipulation of American opinion. But now, of course, in China, they really want to do things. And I should tell you that in March, when I was at the University of Hawaii, I got an award from their Confucian Institute, which they told me was the first one of quite a few now established in the United States. So now I've made a full disclosure. Now, my thesis today is that China will never be successful in its quest for soft power recognition, at least in the democratic countries of the world, and not only in the West, but in Japan and India and other states, unless it improves its progress toward the rule of law. As I've said on previous talks here, Chinese in the last 31 years since Deng Xiaoping started the open policy in December 78, China has made remarkable progress in developing a legal system. There was very little to show foreigners interested in law in 1978-79. Now there's a huge amount of legislation, international agreements, multilateral and bilateral, relating to law, tremendous institutional development, courts, well over 3,000 courts in China that have to be developed, 200,000 judges, 165,000 lawyers, maybe 180,000 prosecutors, 300,000 people at least taking the annual bar exam, huge number of law teachers. When I first went to China in 72, there was nobody to meet in the law school world. They were all either hiding out at home or having their heads reshaped down on the farm. When I came back the next year, I met a couple of law professors, but still legal education wasn't going. And these fellows had much better suntans than I had. They'd been working in the fields for years. I'd been in the Harvard Law School library, and I looked pretty pale. But now I heard just last night at Hong Kong University Law School, the number of law schools or law departments is up to 800. That's astounding. It's more than China can adequately staff, but it's opportunity for legal experts. Getting a job as a judge, prosecutor has become more difficult lately. Many no longer want to be lawyers because of problems lawyers have been having in China. During the 80s and 90s, despite periodic strike hard campaigns to stamp out crime and dissidents, despite June 4th's horrific effect from 1989 to through the 1990s, China made very substantial progress. It has a legal system to show people, and it frequently shows it off. But does it have rule of law? No. But there's no way one can maintain it. Will it have a rule of law? That depends. I mean, I and others don't insist that the Chinese Communist Party should create in China a carbon copy of Western legal institutions. Even though Taiwan in the last 20 odd years has done a remarkable job of adapting Western legal institutions to an important type of rule of law, democratic culture. Nobody says they have to do that on the mainland. It would be nice if the people were free to decide what they should, but even if the leaders decide, together with their limited soundings of popular desires, on doing something different, we should recognize China has a right to do that. And indeed, since the 17th Party Congress, New Line, that seems to reject further formal legal progress, further emphasis on professional in-court legal considerations, not absolutely, but making it secondary and emphasizing contact with the masses, reversion to the old pre-1949 communist liberated areas party line, where the party secretary handled cases, telling the judge who wasn't feeling well he could go home for the day, not to worry about it, emphasizing mediation, participation by the masses, taking soundings with the locality. That's the new line now for a highly sophisticated, extremely impressive China that's playing a huge part in the world. And many people in China, and I, as was said by Douglas, I've just left there and had lots of contact with people. Many people are disillusioned. They think this is the wrong trend. My distinguished friend Zhang Ping from Chinese People's Chinese University of Political Science and Law openly told the lawyers of Beijing who were honoring him that there's an adverse trend since the 17th Party Congress 2.5 years ago. And generally speaking, that is true. Now, of course, the first decade of this century, America lost badly. America has always been the gold standard for Chinese and others in the world about the rule of law, despite our grave deficiencies, largely unknown to others, about racism in the administration of justice, or the limitations of poverty, etc. America had this wonderful reputation, but as we know from events symbolized by Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and the continuing struggle in our courts today of how do we cope with terrorism? How do we cope with the new demands on national security in the light of our traditional values of justice, fairness, due process, constraining government not to impose arbitrary rule on people, not to deny people a fair hearing, not to make them go to military courts, even though they're U.S. citizens accused of misconduct in our own country. This is a struggle every day we're going through now in America. And in the last decade, our soft power reputation has declined a lot. Of course, China's soft power is affected not only by these special problems that China also feels of terrorism, etc., and they're using that always as the excuse for Xinjiang and even Tibet. But China's problems are nationwide systemic. They're not limited to involvement in Iraq or Afghanistan, etc. And there's a struggle in China between this new elite of rising experts who emphasize professional considerations and the party leadership that has helped train them, that has indeed given them a kind of rule of law ideology that's amended the Constitution to promise protection for human rights and property rights, raising the expectations of the masses, the half of China that hasn't benefited from the magnificent economic development as much as the other half, and that increasingly has all kinds of social tensions, grievances, demands, protests that we read about. And Zhou Yongkang, the head of the Communist Party Political Legal Committee for the country, former Minister of Public Security, is openly recognized in an article published in February, it was a speech at the end of last year, that China's social tensions are rising. And even to us outsiders who only see a little bit of China because of the non-transparency maintained by the system, we know from the Honda strike, we know from the insane killings of children, little children, we know from the string of suicides at Foxconn. These are just the tip of the iceberg of a China that yesterday was reported to have 100 million people suffering from mental illness. Well, that's less than 10%, a lot. An earlier report a few weeks ago by Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, I think, reported that 17% of China's population has significant mental illness. But we don't see an adequate institutional response to this problem. We see the manifestations of failure to respond. We see a judicial system that often uses mental institutions to lock up dissidents who are completely sane, except for their courage to challenge the system. And often to lock up the families of dissidents when the dissident himself ought to be having a mental examination, as in the Yang Jia case. Instead of sending Yang Jia for a mental examination of why he killed six policemen, they send his mother for 4 months to be confined even though there's nothing wrong with her except she could have testified about his mental illness, and this kept her from doing so. Well, there's a lot going on that China needs to pay attention to. Some progress is being made. The death penalty is worth focusing on. Chinese leaders are so ashamed of the number of people they execute legally. I'm not talking about the illegal killings. Falun Gong can provide a lot of statistics on that. But I'm talking about people who were legally executed. That is a state secret, closely held. We know that China every year executes more people than all the other countries in the world together. And I think the Chinese government, as it efforts are being made to expand transparency in China, despite state secrets preoccupation, should begin by revealing the truth about the number executed. I think Deng Xiaoping's maxim was right. Sure, sure, Cho, sure, face the facts. And once you know the facts, you can then start some useful further reform. My hope is that death penalty procedural reforms that are underway, although they too remain shrouded in mystery, again, I think unnecessarily, that they will lead to expanded reforms for the rest of criminal justice. And yesterday's announcement demonstrates that, because there were two documents. The first document deals with special procedures for death penalty cases. The second, special reforms for all criminal cases that are serious. Now, if I'm going to be prosecuted for an offense for which I can get life imprisonment, it's intolerable to know I won't get all the benefits that somebody gets who may get a suspended death sentence or even the death sentence. I think any good reforms introduced in the trial and review of death cases will inevitably soon spread to the rest of the system. At least that's my hope. I'm an optimist. Otherwise, I would have studied Russia instead of China. So, torture. China, of course, has a situation where torture has been endemic, no matter how many times it's been banned legally. Yesterday's documents are merely the most recent attempt not only to ban torture, but to put some teeth into it, and to say the consequences of torture, coerced confession, cannot be used, and here's the procedure finally for asserting it, not merely claiming the principle, but showing you the procedure and the practice. Well, I also ought to mention, of course, what we all turn away from, the fantastically horrible treatment of Falun Gong people. I have often, like many other people, found the Falun Gong annoying, peculiar. As a public speaker and writer, they trail me, they're constantly badgering me for interviews, they're doing silly things in some countries to get attention, but their plight deserves serious consideration. Otherwise, we're implicitly treating them like the Chinese used to treat counter-revolutionaries. I once was condemned by Prime Minister Li Peng for saying that the courts of China are instruments of oppression. And when five law school deans met in my hotel lobby to register their strong protest how a friend of China could say such an outrageous thing, I said I was merely quoting the Chief Justice of China, who said the courts must be used as an instrument to repress counter-revolutionaries. And the answer was, oh, that's counter-revolutionaries. They're not the people. Going back to Chairman Mao's distinction between the people and the enemy among the people. Well, Falun Gong are also people. And they're not the only ones, of course, who have been treated so horribly. But we shouldn't ignore that. We can't turn away from that. That too is part of soft power. Today's news says Liu Xiaobo has been moved to Liaoning Province prison. That will be a punishment further for him because it will mean his family will have much greater difficulty going to visit him. The attack on lawyers, the recent conviction of Beijing lawyer Li Zhuang, who tried to defend some of the people charged with organized crime in Chongqing was a powerful warning, not just to Chongqing lawyers, they were already neutralized, but to Beijing lawyers who frequently go all over the country because the local lawyers aren't free to play a part in the defense of the accused. I have something in today's Wall Street Journal about the continuing plight of Gao Zhisheng. Chinese government would like us to forget him. We're all getting tired. I'm getting tired writing about Gao Zhisheng. We all suffer from a kind of compassion fatigue. But they're counting on us forgetting this. And this is a case with no legal basis at this point that the Chinese government is willing to give us. Usually they give you some generalized fig leaf. On Saturday, I think it was, yeah, I visited a lawyer I always wanted to meet, an ex-lawyer named Jung Eun-chong. He's also got an article I saw this morning on the internet. I don't know how he managed to do it, but it shows us having lunch together in his apartment. I tried to meet him 4 years ago, soon after he came out of prison. He was a lawyer who had his license taken away and then refused to stop advising people who had lost their housing rights in the Shanghai development scam. And they gave him 3 years in prison and a year depriving him of his right to participate, his political rights, and it's always vague what that encompasses. But 3 years ago, there was no further legal restraint on him. And since then, the police are all around him. They've turned his apartment into a prison. He cannot leave. It's very difficult for his wife to leave. They only have the most uncertain communication. He's got two security guards on his floor. He has nice relations with them. He introduced me to them. They were reading the Bible at his request. That's interesting. One of the interesting things is how detainees, whether in formal prison or detained at home, develop intimate relations with their captors. I remember the Song Yo-mi case. He was a Dickinson College librarian who got locked up by the security people in 1999. All the 25-year-old crew-cut Chinese who were his captors called him Lao Shi because he would educate them. He had been a professor of Chinese literature in Shanghai, and they respected him, and they were hoping he'd be released. These are interesting human questions. In lawyer, ex-lawyer Jung's place, you not only had these two guys on the 14th floor where he lives, you had somebody at the entrance and some entrance to the parking lot, the courtyard of his house, and then someone at the entrance to the elevator lobby to go up to his apartment. And we had gone there Friday to make another attempt, and we were told come back Saturday. And finally, after a lot of sweet talking by my colleague, who was more persuasive than I, the police surprised us and said, you can go up, as they occasionally have done. And we had this lawyer, Jung, as a pistol. I could see why they don't want to let him out to talk, because he talks well, and he's got a lot of experience, and he's not a human rights person. He was an ordinary member of the masses who spent 11 years during the Cultural Revolution in the Northeast countryside. He worked in a factory. He only went to law school late, but he believed in law. So he comes from, you might say, an unquestionable class background. And yet he became a kind of symbol because of what they've been doing to lawyers. Yesterday, my friend Li Haping, whose license has been taken away in Beijing, I hope only temporarily, he was taken to the police station and finally released last night. When I called up his partner a year ago in Beijing, I said, why don't you come to my hotel and have dinner? He said, I'll call you back. I have to go outside and ask my watchman, the representative of the security branch of the Public Security Bureau, the so-called Guobao. Then he called me back. He said, my watchman says, no, you can't go see Professor Cohen if you want to go to the office tomorrow. You got to choose. Every communication is monitored. My dear friend, the blind man Chen Guangcheng, so-called barefoot lawyer because he never formally studied law, when he challenged the local government because they failed to follow the nation's birth control policy. And when he challenged them because they were violating the nation's criminal procedure law by the way they were abusing thousands of people who didn't want to obey the local authorities restricting their birth control rights, they locked him up. He's been in for 3 years. He's due out in a few more months. But we don't know what will happen to him when he comes out. He too may suffer this unauthorized, endless, lifelong house arrest. Not only are the public interest lawyers who are human rights, the so-called Weitrend Lucier, under attack now, but you know from reading the press that public interest firms that weren't formally thought to be dissident, like the women's law group at Peking University, have been cut off from their administrative support and their financial support. And organizations like the Gungmen, Open Government Information Group, have been cut off from foreign financial support. Their leader, Xu Zhiyong, a very able younger lawyer, was locked up for 30 days and pretty badly affected when he came out. He's been, ever since he came out, he's been much more careful in what he says. We just had Wang Yinhai, the medical specialist specializing in AIDS problems, who's temporarily forced to give up the ghost and retreated to the United States, and his organization may well be closed soon. There are a lot of these problems. I could go on. I think many of you are familiar with the laundry list. But let me say just on re-education through labor, the ability of the police to put anybody away for 3 or 4 years with no prosecutor approval required, no court approval required. Everyone thought that's going to be abolished 7 years ago. The Public Security Ministry has successfully fought that back, and in the new climate, I see little prospect, although again, under the surface, people are making good suggestions and carefully studying when the political climate is ready, how to do away with that or limit that. The treatment of people who are mentally ill is a very serious concern, as I said earlier. Now, how can China hope to win the world's soft power belief? How will it develop its credence? One way would be finally to ratify the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. This would do a lot. Taiwan recently did that, even though Taiwan can't formally participate in the international system. For its internal law, it has adopted that law, and the implications of that are being worked out in Taiwan through the Taiwan Constitutional Court. I don't agree with the decision they made the other day, too conservative, but I do think most of their decisions are very progressive and they've had a real impact. China hasn't even begun to implement a way of interpreting and applying China's constitution. That's left to the party to do as they see fit. Well, the pressure is growing in China. Social reform is increasingly being demanded. And the new force that's coming on the scene, we know from recent events, is labor. An interesting article the other day by Jeff Wasserstrom, a political scientist historian out in California, comparing what's going on here to the famous May 30th, 1925 labor movement unrest in China. He shows important differences leading him to believe labor may not become a serious problem in China. But one thing I didn't see in his discussion, maybe it was there and I missed it, the new technology, the new information spread suggests there's a capacity for this labor thing to grow like wildfire. And it was Chairman Mao who worried about a single spark can start a prairie fire. That's why the party on June 4th, 1989 decided to kill so many people, because they were afraid otherwise that prairie fire would spread once labor people started to join the students in protest. This thing could really wreck China's hard acquired reputation as the workhouse, the factory of the world, not only because it will result in higher wages, but it could result in the kind of instability that foreign investors dread, and I used to represent foreign investors for over 20 years. Well, President Obama has been trying to restore the reputation of the United States. He's finding it harder work than he anticipated. It's even hard to close Guantanamo. And in a badly divided country, the United States, there isn't the easy political support for doing some of the things Obama said he would do in his campaign. But progress is being made slowly. I hope further progress will be made in the United States, and I hope that yesterday's two documents would be a straw in the wind, showing the party leadership, which wants China to have a better reputation abroad, but is deathly afraid of making some of the changes that could lead immediately to further instability. They're afraid of the kind of institutional change Chiang Kai-shek feared in Taiwan, but his son ultimately gave in to. They're afraid of the kind of pressures in South Korea General Park and General Chun wouldn't yield to, but their successors have had to. And I hope the Chinese leadership after the 18th Party Congress in a couple of years will demonstrate somebody up there in the party Politburo Standing Committee who will do for law reform and China's reputation for soft power what Zhu Rongji did for China joining the WTO and undertaking the economic reforms that have led to its phenomenal progress. I'd be happy to have questions or criticisms, whatever. Thank you.
Much, Professor. We have time for a couple of questions from the audience. Anyone would like to ask a question? Start with you, Francis.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. Thank you very much, Professor, for your very illuminating, as always, revelation of what's going on and what you fear will happen. I think I would be remiss, given the date on which we're speaking, if I didn't ask you about June 4th, which you alluded to. You've been here in Hong Kong, which under the one country, two systems has a funny relationship with China, certainly with the court system and the legal system. And since you've been here, I think I'm right to say you were here when the police took away the June 4th statuary that was being held as part of a protest outside Times Square. I'm wondering how you view these events and how you view Hong Kong and how you view its rule of law vis-a-vis the larger issue of China's soft power.
Well, it's a question that's far from the academic. Certainly, everybody in Taiwan watches with the greatest interest here. And people on the mainland also looked at Hong Kong as hope for the future. That's why you had this tainted milk lawsuit brought here, because it was being frustrated in the mainland. The leadership here seems to be inevitably responsible to the leadership in Beijing, and they're demonstrating that they too are against undue popular protest. I happen to think that's unfortunate and wrong. I'm going to be meeting tonight with some of the leaders of the human rights lawyers who support progress in China as well as in this town, and I'll learn a lot more about it. I don't purport to be up to date or a local law expert, but I think politically this is the wrong move. On the other hand, the leadership is very concerned in Hong Kong about showing Beijing that things are under control. Beijing has this morbid fear of any sign of instability, and they can't stop petitioners here the way they can in Beijing, but they can frustrate them to a certain extent. And that's what I think. It seems a shame. It seems, makes me sad to think that leaders in China who have produced so much, taken hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, responded in so many useful ways to make China once again a great country, that they're so afraid I used to think that about Lee Kuan Yew when he was running Singapore, and he wouldn't allow anybody into Singapore who had long hair. But I could explain that because he had just spent a month at Harvard, where he developed a fear of long-haired intellectuals. But what the basis for the fear is in the leadership, I think they know better than we how much instability there is. And like all leaders, they're reluctant to see anything further that's bad happen on their watch. They'd rather repress people and let it all explode on the next guy's watch. They just want to end their term in the next 2 years with at least apparent stability. Yes, Tom?
Yeah, you just mentioned the Mill case, and I just looked it up. It was dismissed apparently on jurisdictional grounds in Hong Kong. What do you think about the notion of extending jurisdiction for Chinese legal cases to this other part of the country with a different system? What do you think about the legal
This decision just came down. I've been traveling from Shanghai. I haven't seen it yet.
Do you think Hong Kong should have some jurisdictional authority over the mainland?
I think Hong Kong has to be very careful. They have to observe the same principles of private international law that other separate jurisdictions have to observe. You can't play it both ways. You can't be insulated in many ways, as Hong Kong fortunately is, from the mainland legal jurisdiction, and then say you want to start making exceptions when they seem attractive. But I can't go beyond that general maxim because I haven't yet studied the case.
Yes. Seth Peterson, I've been watching China for a number of years. I wonder if you could comment about the meeting last month in Washington on human rights. Mm. And there was an article of Wei Jingsheng a few days ago commenting that the human rights dialogue at the government level is almost absent now.
Yeah.
And your perspective on the role, if any, that the U.S. might play in this.
Very good question. I have never been enthusiastic about these official intergovernmental dialogues. I regard it as a form of babysitting foreign prime ministers and foreign ministers so they could go home and say to their constituents, why, we are doing something about human rights in China. Chinese never like to discuss concrete cases. They like to discuss general principles, and they cut off these dialogues anytime they're unhappy with anything that has happened in the bilateral relationship. I was glad, however, that the US and China did agree to meet, and I've been on the periphery of that. It's a good start. They agreed on resurrecting a dialogue between legal experts. One problem in the general dialogue between governments is not many of the dialoguers have influence or knowledge about the problems, and they're all playing given roles. The experts should do better, but when the experts will meet, what the topics will be, remain to be seen. The new Assistant Secretary for Human Rights, Labor, etc., in the State Department, Mike Posner, is a lifelong lawyer advocate for human rights, a dynamic, imaginative person. The new Secretary of State, Assistant Secretary of State level, who's the legal advisor of the State Department, Harold Koh, former Dean of Yale Law School. He used to be in the Clinton administration, the Assistant Secretary of Human Rights. These are top of the line people. Their hearts are in the right place, but they're caught in the broader political, economic, military, diplomatic tangles that the US and China are embroiled in. But Mike Posner did get inserted into last week's strategic and economic dialogue, a place for human rights on the agenda. I have not talked to him since that meeting was held. My advice was, if you want to make dialogues meaningful, you have to talk to the people in China who know and who are powerful. All these dialogues aren't worth a damn if you have an opportunity to talk to Zhou Yongkang, the head of the Party Political Legal Committee, former Minister of Public Security. If you can talk to the Prosecutor General, talk to the Minister of Justice, talk to the head of the court system. These are the party's appointees. Some of them know about law, most of them don't. but they know what the new party line is about, and they need to learn a lot more about law. If we could get to the people who make policy, who affect enforcement, that would be a real meaningful human rights dialogue. At the same time, the Chinese are trying, for soft power reasons again, I'm glad you raised this, through the State Council Information Office, they've developed something called the China Human Rights Foundation. And they have started. We took part through the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations in what they like to call Track 2 meeting last December on human rights. We're hoping to have another meeting in September or October. At first, I didn't take it seriously because they're under the propaganda apparatus. But they did put together a pretty good discussion. They didn't produce all the people we wanted to meet. The Ministry of Public Security boycotted. They didn't want to face questioning by foreigners who knew something about the Chinese legal system. But hope springs eternal in the human breast. We're just starting the discussion about next fall's discussion. It's not really Track 2. Our side is Track 2. We're not officials. Their side is mostly officials. But they like to call it Track 2, and if it facilitates some kind of a dialogue that's more meaningful than the government-to-government dialogue, I have nothing better to do with my time. But I don't have great hope that this will change the party line. You've got to reach the people on the top. And if, for example, the Chongqing party secretary, Shi Bolai, is successful in riding his wave of suppressing organized crime in Chongqing into a more impressive spot on the Politburo, I don't think he's going to be the new leader who's going to be sensitive to the need for law reform because of the way he's prosecuted an outstanding Beijing lawyer and intimidated all the others. His is a more typical attitude. You got to crack down on crime. You don't need to worry about lawyers. If you read Zhou Yongkang's report I referred to earlier, if you were a man from Mars and you read that report, you would not know that China had a single lawyer. He talks about improving the police, the prosecution, the court, and never a word about, although he says we should have a fairer criminal justice system, it doesn't seem to occur to him. You can't have one unless you have lawyers who have an opportunity freely to pursue the craft of the defense lawyer.
I see a couple other questions. Maybe just one final question. We are running a little bit late.
Thank you. Professor Cohen, it was very interesting. And you talked about the rule of law as the answer for China to get more soft power. But isn't the rule of law, my question to you is it compatible to a one-party system? Or is the maximum China can achieve is a kind of rule of law that is in Singapore, for example?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Of course, if China could achieve the rule of law level of Singapore, that would have to be seen as progress, even if only interim to a more genuine rule of law. But it depends, of course, how a one-party state evolves. The central party school research people in Beijing are highly sophisticated, and they've been looking at the evolution of one-party states in a variety of countries, Indonesia, Japan, etc. Now, you could say until recently, Japan essentially has had a one-party state, but as we know, a Japanese party has many factions, and so does a Chinese party. I don't think in order to have some kind of credible rule of law system, you have first to have a democratic, political, Western-style electoral system. It's preferable, it's possible to do more, however, without it. Indonesia has made some progress, but not enough. But they're looking around at ways in which to do this. I do think an increasingly free media is critical to any meaningful rule of law. The relationship between the media and the legal system is complex and intimate, and many judges in China have talked to me about how can they handle a question when the media is calling for blood and death sentence, et cetera. And lawyers often try to use the media, sometimes buying good media opinion. And we're dependent for investigative reporting by some of the especially Guangdong-based newspapers who seem to have an increasing degree of scope to investigate things, at least outside their own province. This is a very complex, but without a free media, I don't think there will be a genuine rule of law. Both have to progress. Of course, a free media will increase demands for a popular electoral system. There is a felt need in China now, as there is in every country, including Japan, which has just adopted a kind of jury judge system to let the jury play a role in criminal cases together with judges. Every system has to look, and China's included, how do you really incorporate the wishes of the people into a legal system and keep that legal system fair, not arbitrary? And there are all kinds of experiments now being talked about and some underway in China. I think China's got to be the most interesting place in the world to study, but that's easy for me because I'm going to go back to my country tomorrow and I'll be able to sit in my study and say and write what I want. It's not so easy if you're in China and you have to daily live with the consequences.
On the note of the importance of the free media and something you always like to hear here at the FCC, I'd like to invite the audience here to join me in thanking you, Professor, for such a wonderful talk.
Thanks.
And also, if I may, another little tidbit about the professor. You may not be aware that he has a very auspicious birthday this year. And it's even more auspicious for the fact that he shares it with a great organization that he's been talking with us about today, the Chinese Communist Party. But it is his birthday at the beginning of July, and in honor of that, we prepared a little cake for you.
Oh.
And for anyone in the audience who would like to come up and share a piece of cake with the professor and maybe ask a question that we didn't have time for, I'd like to invite you to do that. Thank you very much again, Professor.
Yeah, let's put it over there. Thanks.